Blind Cool Tech 208, November 1, 05.
Coming to you from Louisville, Kentucky, it's the Blind Cool Tech Podcast, the podcast about ordinary, everyday blind people. Now, here's the host of Blind Cool Tech, the fastest talking guy in Kentucky, Mr. Excitement, Larry Scoochcon.
All right, Steve. Thank you. That is too funny. I'm not sure what that says about Kentucky, but we know I talk slow. Hey, we've got a full show for you today, and I want to especially thank Steve Bauer for that excellent introduction. Kai has sent in some great ones. Jamie Pauls, this is too much fun, you guys. This shouldn't be legal. All right, we've got an interview with Carol Jordan Stewart today. She is a narrator for the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and a narrator extraordinaire, I might add. Got a Halloween prank that Grant Hardy wants to share with you. And finally, we'll wrap out this issue with a review by Keith Creasy of the XM MiFi satellite receiver.
Blind Cool Tech.
I wanted to play with the podcast stuff, okay?
Technology.
A world.
And blindness.
Ah, God. Who put that wall there?
Can all come together. It's another Blind Cool Tech special guest presentation.
When the silence that followed had become uncomfortable, he added, "I am just about to take tea. Pray come and have some with me." A little stiff, perhaps, but he meant it kindly. And what would you do if an uninvited dwarf came and hung his things up in your hall without a word of explanation? They had not been at table long, in fact, they had hardly reached the third cake, when there came another even louder ring at the bell.
If you're a patron of the National Library Service, you'll be familiar with that voice. That is the voice of Carol Jordan Stewart, who is now the director of the studio at American Printing Houses for the Blind. And I have Carol, the person behind that voice, Carol Jordan Stewart, in the office with me right now. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Larry.
We are really excited to get you here because I've come to find out since I've done this podcast that there you have a lot of fans out there, kind of like being Hollywood.
You know? Well, it's always nice to hear, you know, you sit in the studio and you read the books and then they disappear. It has this, you know, no existential kind of a quality that your work isn't going anywhere. So it's always nice to know that people are listening and enjoying what we're doing.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'll bet we'll get some feedback from this show. Do you want to share your contact info or anything?
If sure,
people
absolutely.
Write you some,
My office number is 502-899-2234, or you can email me here at APH at cstewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, at aph.org.
Okay, great. Well, to start out, do you want to just give us a description of how narration is from the professional side? We're always, you know, looking at it from the consumer side and enjoying the acting and narration. So how is it, you know, maybe if you could give us a little of your background, were you trained in theater or... How you
sure.
get into all this? Just
yeah,
go
people
ahead and
come
talk.
To narration from different places. Some people come more from broadcasting or television or whatever. I do have a theater background. I went to the Goodman School of Drama, which is now, I think, part of DePaul University, is the theater school, a very memorable name, and graduated from there in the 80s. And I don't know, I guess my theater training helped prepare me for narration. I think really what made the biggest difference is that I spent enormous amounts of my time, and still do, but especially when I was growing up, just losing myself in books. And I think when I listen to other narrators, I think for me what is the most compelling is people who do lose themselves in the telling of a story. And by telling of a story, I mean either fiction or nonfiction. Nonfiction has stories too, even if it's something that can be fairly technical. If you're explaining something, you're telling the story of how something works. And people who can really put themselves to one side and let the author and let the book just, well, sort of serve as a vehicle of delivery for the mm-hmm. book, as opposed to, you know, oh, I want to put my stamp on the book, or mm-hmm. I want to make sure my voice sounds really good when I read that. And there are people, not just in the NLS program, but there are people that I hear doing commercial narration that sometimes, you know, veer in that direction. And while their voices are pleasing and sometimes their books are really good, it's not what I prefer. I'd rather have someone with, you know, an okay voice or an interesting voice who really knows how to tell a story.
And how is it, how do you get into the characters as you're narrating? How do you know how to put a certain slant on a particular character? Do you just go into it cold, or do you
read the books in advance. I think, I don't know, narrators have different approaches. Some people like to read cold because then they like the element of surprise, mm-hmm. the same way that you experience that as a reader, and they use that to help them motivate. I call that narration roulette. I know as studio directors, sometimes that you get caught. You know, you find out that a character whose name is spelled H-E-A-T-H-E-R on page 300, they reveal that her name is really Heather, you know. because the author couldn't think of anything else to do or something. But,
right.
You don't like those kinds of surprises. Those are bad.
And you can't leave that sentence out, I guess.
No, NLS doesn't like that. Coming from a theater background where, you know, you would have 4 to 6 weeks, if you're lucky, to rehearse something that only takes an hour or two in performance, and going from that to, you know, an average size book is 12 hours usually when it's finished, and takes about twice that long to record it in the studio. So what I try to do, and what I try to help newer narrators learn how to do, is to read the book and read it as a reader and really focus on how you've internalized that book as a whole and how the different characters struck you and what they meant to you personally. And then, because you don't really have any rehearsal time, try to channel that directly back out of your mouth. You know, what kind of emotional response did I have to this particular scene? And then to just respond organically to how you would create that. Some characters I'm more deliberate about. If characters are written in dialect, especially dialect that I know good at, like French, that requires a certain level of preparation. Or if they're indicated by the author as having an unusual vocal quality. I had a character once who was described as having had a damaged windpipe, and so he always talked like this.
Okay.
So there are different technical things, but I do tend to rely a lot on my own response as a reader to the character in terms of how I generate what they sound like or what their rhythm is like or what drives them.
That's fascinating. So what dialects are you good at?
I'm pretty good at German, Spanish. For a while, I was actually, because we were talking about the Poisonwood Bible before we started doing this interview, and for a while, I was pretty good at an East African dialect, but that probably has passed now.
Well, Carol, you know the kind of crazy kind of show this is. We're not going to let you get away without giving us some samples.
I do remember the line from the Poisonwood Bible that I would use sort of as a warm up to remind myself of the dialect that I was using for a lot of the characters in that book. Is a scene early on, if you've read the book, where the family first arrives in Africa and there's this huge feast and they're appalled. They're this very protected family from South Georgia and they've never been out of the country. And here they are in this very remote part of Africa, surrounded by people who are totally different from them, in a place that they could not possibly prepare for being. And the mayor, the leader of this little village, stands up and wants to welcome them, and he says, "Welcome to our feast. We hope that you will eat much of our fufu pili pili," which fufu pili pili apparently is very spicy goat.
Okay. Great.
So yeah, everybody go out and get fufu pili pili.
Now, can you do Southern Georgia too?
I'm not good at Southern Georgia. I can do sort of a generic. I certainly can do Kentucky. That the roundness of Southern Georgia takes me a little while to fall into. I mean, yeah. It's not terribly accurate.
So I take it some of these dialects you actually practice for?
I do have to practice for. Other things like, well, I had a roommate for a while that was from Green Bay, Go Pack. So that one comes pretty naturally. I do like Midwestern dialects. I was delighted when I saw the movie Fargo because that's half the movie. Some of them do come more easily.
Okay. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I read a book once where one of the characters, it was one of my favorite books too, The Magician's Assistant, and by Ann Patchett, the woman that wrote Bel Canto, which was popular a couple years back. And one of the main characters was a Vietnamese man who had been raised in France and was living in L.A. In a Vietnamese-French dialect, no way. No way could I do that.
Not even going to try.
I gave him sort of an altered rhythm that indicated some sort of flavor of some kind of dialect, but there was no way that I could do that.
Okay, well, yeah, that was distinguishable, though, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Carol, what would you say is the most memorable book that you've narrated?
Another answer to one of the questions you asked earlier about the special things about narration.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to sort of combine those answers. When I record books, and I've talked to other narrators who have sometimes had this experience too, I think often of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. And I don't know if you've read that, but at the end of the book, because all of the books have been burned, there's a community of people, and it's their responsibility for each citizen in this hidden community to be a book that they have each memorized, that the book has been handed down to them verbally by another person, and that individual becomes the repository for the book. And if a book is really well written, there is an element of being the book when I narrate that is really moving. And certainly that was something that I experienced on The Poisonwood Bible, or I recorded To Kill a Mockingbird. The book that I just mentioned a minute ago, The Magician's Assistant, was a very moving book to me, and it's not a book that many people would necessarily read. But sometimes I've found at the end of books that surprise me, that I get kind of choked up in the last sentence, and even in the, this is the end of blah, 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 whatever the book was. That closing announcement, that sort of shutting the door on the book and saying goodbye to my experience of those characters or that world, or even sometimes just the way the narration feels physically, that, authors have very distinct rhythms and timbres to their writing. And saying goodbye to that can sometimes be really sad. But I would say Poisonwood Bible, that was such a challenge technically, but then also the story is so astounding.
Yeah.
And then being immersed in it for so long because it's such a long book. But I've been very fortunate. I've gotten to record any number of fantastic books.
Yeah. But what about some bad ones?
Those stand out in a different way. I'm going to get, hate mail from authors. How dare you? A series that I did, and this will draw great ire, which is why I'm going to go ahead and mention it because it is funny. Orson Scott Card is a very popular author, and I can see why people really, really love his work. I did a series of 4 or 5 books of his, and I was so frustrated with, I wrote him a letter. It's the only time I've ever written to an author to say, somebody has to read your books out loud. And he had put in a listing of pronunciations for the characters' names at the end of each of the books, and I think he was trying to give it sort of a Russian flavor, how there are different diminutives in Russian depending upon, or different titles depending upon your relationship to the person and things like that. And he had said that the pronunciation of the name would be determined by the relationship of the person, and that there would be a Y inserted before a vowel in any of the syllables of the name depending upon their,
oh, man.
It was a nightmare. And so, there was one character that was named, it looked like Gabalufix, but he might be Gabalufix or Gabialufix or Gabalufix or Gabalufix, depending upon who was talking to him.
Yeah.
And It was a, they were long books, 15 sides, and four of them, and Orson Scott Card is my arch nemesis. But oddly, he never wrote back to me.
Huh.
But maybe well, not so oddly.
He may be a listener of Blind Cool Tech. So.
Well, Orson, you owe me big time, like dinner or something. There are books that I have hated. I mean, just hated that people have called to tell me that they really enjoyed, which makes me feel like I have really done my job as a professional narrator, because it didn't. I managed to not communicate that this book was somehow killing my soul. There was a book that I read where I was literally falling asleep.
Oh, man.
While I was, which I had never thought was possible. I knew that one of our narrators, he's no longer with us, David Palmer, was famous in the APH studio for falling asleep while reading. And when I first started narrating, I thought, you know, that is just not possible. But it's just like when somebody talks about falling asleep when they're driving.
Yeah.
You're just doing the same thing, and it's really monotonous, and your mind starts to wander. And the next thing you know, was I talking? What did I just say? And then you hear the monitor in your ear, Carol. It's very disconcerting.
It's time to get up, Carol.
It's
morning.
So, I did one of those V.C. Andrews series.
Oh, did you?
Which kind of skeeved me out, because they're, you know, the romance is all kind of incestuous and creepy. But, you know, people really like those.
They did
my best. And I do, that's one of the series that I still get comments on every once in a while. People really loved it, but man, it grossed me out.
Which series was it, do you recall?
It was the series where the main character was named Dawn. So all the titles have Dawn in them.
Yeah,
Dawn
okay.
does this, or Dawn falls in love with her brother that she doesn't know is her brother. I don't know what their names were, but...
My friend is reading one of those right now, and she can't put it down.
I mean, they are quite riveting, you know? I mean, for me, it was riveting like a train wreck. Like, it could, like, oh my God. But people really like them, and, you know, the stories are compelling in their way. You know, I don't really like, you know, horror or really hardcore thriller kinds of stuff, you know, that gets really violent. But I've read plenty of those, and they are quite riveting.
Yeah.
They freak me out, but I've read them.
Is there a book you've read that you would like to narrate?
Oh, yeah. I often read things and think, oh, that would be so much fun to narrate. I'm trying to think of something that I read just recently. I bet every third or fourth book that I read that I
like. Is that right?
I want to narrate that. Huh. Or sometimes it's a book that I would really love to narrate that I know that I can't, you know, because it's first person male.
Yeah.
There's a series that I was working on for a while that I would have liked to have done more on. It was Donald Kellerman, that had a lot of interesting characters, and it was fun.
Well, what does the Carol Stewart away from American Printing House for the Blind lean towards in her reading preferences?
Gosh, I read constantly. I read both with my eyes, and I read by listening. I listen to a lot of commercial audio.
Do you? Audible.com?
Yeah. I'm quite partial to Recorded Books Incorporated, which, you know, you still have to wield cassettes and all.
Yeah.
But my favorite narrators are there. And but yeah, I use a lot of Audible. And I download radio shows from Audible too, which I like. I'm real fond of, like, This American Life and that Lynn Rossetto Casper cooking show.
Okay.
But yeah, I listen to my favorite commercial narrators. I'm a huge fan of George Goodell, that works for Recorded Books, and Barbara Rosenblatt. Frank Muller is someone who I've always really enjoyed. He was in a bad motorcycle accident several years ago and isn't narrating anymore. But those are people that I can go back and listen to their books, the same books, over and over again. And their enjoyment of what they're narrating is so apparent and so compelling.
Okay. And Frank Muller, was he with Audible? That name sounds familiar.
He did, because he recorded most of Stephen King's books.
So
he recorded them for... he's an interesting example of how authors are sometimes resistant to audio, and then they're won over by a really good narrator. Stephen King had always resisted commercial narration. Now, you know, they'd sold audio rights to Recorded Books for years, but he would never listen to them, and he would record his own version of the audio for whoever his publisher was. And then one day, I guess somebody made him sit down and listen to Frank Muller's recording of his books, and he never went back. From then on, it was only Frank Muller that was going to be recording Stephen King.
I'll be darned.
And Frank, he did that creepy stuff.
Yeah.
He was good at that.
I think I've heard him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's fantastic, fantastic narrator.
That's amazing. Do you listen to any podcasts?
I have just opened the door to podcasts. A friend of mine here in Louisville has started a podcast hosting site. And so I've been sort of perusing the selections and getting ready to jump in. So this is still pretty new to me.
Okay, great. Well, I was telling our listeners that you were interested in starting your own podcast. I didn't say anything about what it was or anything, but do you want to talk about that any? Or?
Sure. In my spare time outside of the studio, I'm involved with a group of refugee Tibetan monks. And I know that's odd for someone from Louisville, but that's just the way things worked out. And one of them lives here in Louisville and does a lot of Tibetan Buddhist Dharma teaching, which is just, you know, like lecturing on Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. And we have people that come regularly and listen to him, and then sometimes they can't come, and someone had suggested, hey, would you be willing to tape these for me? And I thought, man, I'm not going to mess with cassette tapes. We're past cassette tapes, man. This is the future. So anyway, I thought, podcast, that would be perfect. So that's going to be my podcast venture, all Tibetan right. Buddhist philosophy.
We'll all be listening.
Yeah, I bet. Don't run over each other now trying to get to the hosting site.
Now, do you still narrate here, Carol, or are you mainly?
I haven't narrated in a couple of years, just because, you know, we try to keep supervision and narration separate now. But I really, really miss it. I was doing some commercial narration for a while, and I haven't pursued that recently either. And, you know, your question earlier about, do you see books that you'd like to narrate? And yeah, I see them all the time. I get very, very homesick for narration. I think it's, while it is not the most regular way to make an income in the world, I think in some ways it's one of the things that I'm best at. The reason that I'm a better narrator than I was an actor, because what I discovered once I was able to get into the studio is that I don't actually like acting in front of people. That I'm an introvert, and so doing stuff in front of people is kind of nerve-wracking. So being able to just sit in this totally silent room and listen to this story unfold in my head is something that apparently I'm pretty good at, and it is something that I really, really enjoy.
So you don't have any qualms about just kind of talking to yourself?
No. And it's better, actually, if I have a script, because then I don't sound like I'm insane. As opposed to like when I just walk through my house or down the street or something, talking to myself, telling myself little stories.
Well, you know, I may have told you this, but when I first moved to Louisville, I thought, wow, this is like being in Hollywood, when I'd run into like you in the hall or Milton Metz or whatever. Because you'd been hearing these voices on the talking books for years and years, and then you actually see these people in person or hear them on the radio or something. It's really quite the experience.
When I try to communicate that both to new narrators and also to people who come here to visit APH, you know, people who are just touring APH because we're an interesting business and they don't really know anything about talking books and. You know, Terry Sales is a perfect example. I adore her. She's a very good friend of mine. And I'm not going to say her age because she'd hit me. But, you know, she's been reading a while.
Well, she always says she was here when this before this building.
Well, she is the only narrator in the NLS system that I'm aware of who started recording on wax cylinders and is still recording now that we're doing DTBs.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's such a precise narrator because when you recorded on wax cylinders, the cylinders were 15 minutes long and you couldn't make any mistakes. So you either had to make the mistake sound like it was right or you had to start over. And she is precise. Even now, she goes into the studio for 2 hours and comes out and says, well, I didn't do so great today. It was only 82 minutes finished material. But, you know, she is someone who people have literally grown up listening to her read. And the same is true for a lot of our narrators. But, you know, with Terry, people who are middle-aged and a little above have been growing up listening to Terry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about as a sighted person that there are books that have been so meaningful to me throughout my life that I go back and reread, or that I recall with, you know, great specificity what they meant to me or how they affected my life. And to have that book associated with a certain voice, it makes absolute sense to me why that's so powerful. You know, it means that every time I read To Kill a Mockingbird, I hear that same voice telling me that story. You know, it's like you can't hear To Kill a Mockingbird and not hear Gregory Peck. There are some things that you just can't separate. So it makes a great deal of sense to me why people are so fond of the narrators, why it means so much to them.
Well, you're mentioning how technology has affected the recording process since the wax cylinder and so forth. How has it changed and affected you since you've been involved in narration?
I came in where we had just changed from the older reel-to-reel machines that didn't have any time markers on them. And so the narrators, the monitors, I mean, were so relieved at about the time that I got here because they no longer basically had to use the force to find where they were on it. You know, they would have to literally look at a reel of tape and say, okay, well, we made a mistake at 55 minutes and be able to determine where they were. It was like voodoo. We were still splicing tape when I started. If there were glitches in the tape, we would work with that. Rewinding tape takes forever.
Well, and wasn't there a pretty good delay in there too when you use a narrator?
Yes, there was this weird jump thing. Mostly that's because of how our intercom system works. That in our studios, when you turn off the recording function, your microphone still has a direct connection to the monitor that you're working with on the other side of the booth, and or outside of the booth. And so, but when we do jump into record, the monitor was reviewing a different track than you were recording on. And so there was an element of using the force to find out when you jumped in. In the studio, it would often sound like I was cutting off words because of where I would cut in. But in fact, it was that I was cutting in at a good point. So yeah, that was confusing. But then people have been used to doing that for 15 years, and then you move them into a digital studio where you just cut it at the regular time, and it took forever for the narrators to figure out how to cut themselves in at the right point.
I bet it did.
Yeah.
Well, and what year was it when you came into the system?
I started reading in 1990.
Okay. Tell us about what you do as the director of the studio.
I push people around.
Leave me alone.
Hey, you're being mean. Basically what I do is, you know, our books come in from NLS in big boxes. We get several shipments a year, usually about 40 or 50 at a time. I review those with a team of our full-time employees. We look through the titles, determine, okay, well, this is a thriller, male point of view. This would sound good if, you know, this narrator, this, you know, the potential narrators for this book are Jack Fox, Roy Avers, Rich Hauenstein, John Pohl. You know, make a list for each book. Some books are pretty specific. There's really only one person, or maybe just a couple that might work on it, or that might be possible narrators. And then, you know, we look at the dates, when the book needs to be started by. All that information comes in from NLS. They give us sort of an estimated production period of time for how long they estimate, based on the estimated length of the book, how long they think it'll take us to record the piece. So, you know, we record 500 books a year plus our magazine, so that's a lot of books. I oversee the final assigning of a book when a narrator or monitor comes to me and says, you know, hey, Jack Fox needs a new book. Then I look on the shelves and say, okay, well, these are the books that we potentially assigned to Jack Fox, and this is the next title, so here you go, Collected Stories of Louis L'Amour. The monitor will take the book, do the research, set it up, set up the hierarchy for the DTB for when we do that later. You know, I kind of continue to check in with them, make sure everything's running on track. You know, obviously it's not a big deal with Louis L'Amour, but, you know, more complicated books. Like, we just got in this Popular Mechanics Complete Home How-To.
Ooh, I want it.
You can read it. What a nightmare. So I'll be checking with that team fairly frequently. And so then I just, once the books go into production, kind of keep an eye on them, make sure that they're running according to schedule, because of all of our narrators are part-time. You know, they do other things, especially people in the theater. Fred Major is a good example. He often gets gigs, has to go out of town, so he goes from reading in the studio 5 days a week to one day a week every other week or something. So I have to make sure that books are still moving along. You know, the problem books, you know, we have questions about how to set it up according to the new DTB specs, and I have to check in with NLS. Can we do this? Can we do that? Books that are difficult in terms of research, make sure that the monitors get hooked up with people who are experts in whatever field, you know, they might need assistance in. And just sort of keep an eye on production. I review audition tapes from new narrators, and then we bring them in and help them get ready to make a final demo for NLS. So we just recently got two new narrators, actually. Hmm. So you can look forward to listening to Kate Sanders and Shona Tucker. Some of you probably have heard Shona Tucker already on People magazine. Hmm. That's kind of how I spend my day, chasing down odd pieces of information. How do you pronounce this one street in New Orleans? You know, stuff like that.
So you guys really do put a lot of upfront time into getting pronunciations and...
As much as possible. You can really paint yourself into a corner fast.
Yeah.
You know, like this book about New Orleans, it's, I don't know, it's called Desire. I don't remember what it's about. It's nonfiction. But, you know, it's some sort of police investigation that goes all over New Orleans. And you can get yourself tied into a Cajun pronunciation knot almost immediately if you're not careful. So... So we do try to get a jump on some of those things. You know, other books, Louis L'Amour, you're not going to run into a lot of pronunciation difficulties, because you know he wasn't doing his research when he, like, has people speaking Apache or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, our best estimate is often good enough, but he often resorts to just,
right.
As a statement. So, okay, I can pronounce that. And, but yeah, we do try to make sure that the book is in... Well, fairly ready to go once we start putting down the narration.
How does the digital talking book, is it a favorable effect on the on our end of the production of these kind of books, or is it a non-issue, or what?
No, it's definitely not a non-issue. I think most of our attention right now is on how do you set this book up so that it makes sense for someone who is using a DTB when no one is really using DTBs. So we're having to anticipate how people are going to be using them when no one is really using them.
Yeah.
And, you know, like for cookbooks, right now we're looking at... And they're a prime example of a book that when we used to just do them with tones and stuff, I don't know how anybody could listen to The Joy of Cooking and then make meatloaf. I have no idea how a blind person... would navigate and use a cookbook. You know, Meatloaf is, I don't know, side 27 and tone 54. How do you find anything?
You had to be motivated.
And you had to really want to make that meatloaf. And then you'd get to the end of the recipe and it'd say sauce on page, you know, 452.
Right. We're having hot dogs
sandwich.
Tonight.
Right. You know, so now we have this opportunity to make that kind of a reference book, really, accessible to someone in a whole new way. But how, again, we keep coming up with, and because every book is a little different, the answer is always a little different, how do we make a cookbook accessible? Now, obviously, you'd be able to navigate right to meatloaf, but then how do people record the recipe? Like, do you want to be able to stop at each ingredient? You know, right now, that's how we're marking them. So it's one cup this, one cup, you know, that you're literally going to. And the same thing with the instructions. So huge amount of markup for cookbooks. But we don't know yet if that's helpful. I'm hoping it is, but it's going to be a while to get those, until we get books out there, and then until we can get feedback of, yes, this is great, or why did you guys do this?
Yeah.
Which is what I'm afraid of.
Well, you know, when you were talking about that Mechanics Illustrated book, that was the first thing that popped into my mind. What a great resource that would be if you could get to where you needed to get.
Right. And because right now we're sort of at an in-between place. I mean, ideally, the way a DTB will, I think, eventually work is we'll be recording an index, and then, you know, every index feature will have a go-to. So you go straight to the index in the book, and you go straight to drywall, and then you go straight to, you know, masking or whatever. Yeah. And then you hit go, and there you are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for a while, it's still going to be listening to the table of contents, going, okay, chapter four is wall applications and repairs. And then, you know, you just sort of make your... I mean, you can keep hitting go to the next thing, and eventually you can find it, but it's still not quite where it needs to be. But yeah, that's a perfect example, because you don't really, who cares about, you know, paint applications when really what you will need to do is spackling.
Yeah, exactly.
Or plumbing.
And even that part about going through it by the contents is a tremendous jump forward from counting beeps and changing cassettes.
I don't know how people keep track of cassettes on a book like that. I mean, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be a 39, 45 sided book. It's like, plumbing is on cassette 10? Oh, dude, I don't know where cassette 10 is.
I was looking for an excuse not to do that plumbing anyway.
I would be using that all the time. I couldn't find the side with the meatloaf.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you'd like to tell us about, Carol? I'm sure I missed something important about being a narrator or a studio director?
Well, I think in general, both about narration and being the studio director is that, and I guess I kind of touched on this before, but I hadn't said it specifically, is that I take it very, very seriously that we are the delivery system, again, for how someone else receives a book. And I know from my own experience listening to commercial audio that, you know, there are books that I put in a tape and thought, man, this sucks. And then I'm not going to listen to that book. But I can go and, you know, get the print version or whatever. And for people who don't have that as an option, it's really important to me that as often as we can, that we make that listening experience as compelling and as accurate and as enjoyable as possible, because you don't have as many options. You know, we're kind of all you've got, you know, us and the other studios. And I know how much I love books and how crushing it would be to me if one of my favorite books was poorly narrated. Then I wouldn't be able to have that experience anymore. And so, like I said, as a narrator and as a producer, that's really important to me. And so it's always good for me to hear feedback from people who listen, good and bad. You know, and I can't always say, okay, well, this one guy doesn't like this one narrator, so I've got to fire her. But it is helpful. I mean, I do make decisions often based on what listeners have to say. And, you know, if I try a narrator in a book that is a little different for them, you know, have somebody who normally does more straightforward nonfiction, and I try them on a, maybe on a thriller or something that's a little bit outside of their, like what they usually do, it's very helpful to hear from other people. I mean, I may think they sound great and somebody else may think they sound terrible.
Yeah.
Have him go back to reading stuff about World War II. But, you know, so feedback is always a really good thing. And like I said, I feel like our responsibility is an enormous one. And I try to keep that in mind as much as I can.
Well, it has been a real pleasure and honor having you on Blind Cool Tech, Carol.
Well, thanks.
And do you think I could get you to say something?
Sure.
Like, you're listening to Blind Cool Tech?
Sure. Ooh, I'll squeeze up on the microphone. You're listening to Blind Cool Tech.
Awesome. Thanks, Carol.
Sure, thanks, Larry.
I'm cheap, aren't I?
Hi, Larry. This is Dana again. I guess I missed the mystery sound. Gee, the only other thing I can guess would be something like compressed air in a can. I don't know. Anyway, that'd be my best shot anyway. But I want to tell you, great job on the haunted house. I think the first recorder you were using, I don't know if you were using an R1 or what, the first one did a better job, even though it did tend to overmodulate when you got in loud places. The limiter clipped a lot inside that barn. But anyway, it was great, man. My vote for the best player in that haunted house goes to the Laughing Hatchet Lady, man. She could hold her own with Freddy Krueger or any of those guys. It was great. I really dug it. You guys did a hell of a job on that tour and really enjoyed it. With phones on, man, you got scared just sitting there listening to it with a good set of headphones. So great job. Keep it coming, man. Loving every minute of it. Thanks a lot. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
You too, Dana. Becky was telling me I made her and Kenny a CD of the show, and they were listening to it in the living room today, and she jumped a few times. I didn't get to explain to you guys. What I did was actually use the iRiver on the first part, and I wasn't sure it was going to come out because of those loud noises, so I switched over to the Olympus DS2 on its most high-quality setting for the second part, so that was a good comparison, you know, that we could get a very similar environment to the two recorders, and I have to agree with you. I think the iRiver has got it. It's not nearly as easy to use, but it sure makes a good recording. And the Hatchet Lady, you're right. The one I thought was particularly intense as well was the "Help Me, I Told You to Help Me." She was good.
Hi, everybody. This is Ken Reed from Enfield, Connecticut. I got my iRiver updated, and I found that an amazing thing when I connected it to my new computer. It saw the disk drive right away. It didn't. I didn't have to reload the iRiver software, so that was a neat thing. I didn't expect that. The other thing is, I did get a Olympus 200S, and just in case you're curious, I was curious. I loaded a file that I knew should play. It was I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, I loaded a file in the format that it uses, this Microsoft file format, and you can download it, and you can play it back on your computer, but you can't play it out of the machine. So that was interesting. There must be some difference between the way it handles things and the way it's actually done, when it actually goes in there. And that's all the big things I have to report today is just something's working right. I'm happy with the sound of my WS. I like it. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Oh, it is a good sound, no doubt about it. It is good. I'm just saying that it's not as rich and as full, but it's plenty good for many, many things. That is interesting about it not playing other WMA files, too. You didn't mention, you know, how those WMAs were encoded. I wonder if you limited it to 64 kbps that it could play it then. Yeah, good points, though. Thank you, Ken. We now have a Halloween prank a day late. When I first heard this, I thought, well, this would make some great addition to the brochure and product information for Bookport. But then, maybe not.
Hello there, and happy Halloween to all of you out there listening to Blind Cool Tech. My name is Grant Hardy, and this is my first ever submission to this excellent podcast. Now, I don't know whether I've mentioned it before, but I am a high school student integrated into the mainstream school system in Canada. My school is a great one, with generally hardworking students, but I guess like all high schools, people simply have to find time to conduct their mischief. Every year since I began here at the school, on the afternoon of Halloween, a prankster would set off a smoke bomb, the object of which is to fill the school with smoke, causing the school to be evacuated due to the sound of the fire alarm. And they'd always do this in a convenient stairwell where, from the outside, they were able to open the exit, throw the bomb in, and then run without being caught. Now, this year, fully expecting the smoke bomb as usual, I wanted to hear exactly what it sounded like, because normally you don't hear it from class, you would just hear the fire alarm. So I placed my book port in my locker, which is very near the target staircase, and recorded a memo of Halloween afternoon. I am pleased to say it recorded well, because sure enough, the smoke bomb was set up, or set off. Thus, I can bring you the following, quote, coverage. I'm going to start the recording a few seconds before the bomb was set off. You'll hear the sound, which incidentally is quite powerful, surprisingly powerful. It's very startling, I imagine, to the people in the hall. And then you'll hear a few seconds later the sound of the fire alarm and people running from the building. I hope this recording will prove interesting. It is, of course, a huge disruption and expense for my high school, and of course a very mischievous deed to perform, but those who have never heard a smoke bomb before may find it very interesting, and of course, as I said, it is very powerful. So without further ado, here is, from my book port, the recording. Well, there you have it. I hope you found that somewhat interesting, that recording. Now, what I ideally wanted was to get inside coverage. I wanted to hear kind of the scene of people searching that floor of the school after we all had left. But unfortunately, the book port was not sensitive enough to pick it up. And the rest is pretty much indistinguishable. So, the culprit, as usual, was not caught. The fire department and police were both on the scene. So, once again, quite a dramatic Halloween. Hope you all had a good one, and thank you for listening to this recording.
Coming to you pre-recorded from Louisville, Kentucky, you're listening to Blind Cool Tech.
Blind Cool Tech. Product review.
Hello, my name is Keith Creasy, and I'm bringing you a podcast review of the XM MiFi receiver by Delphi. I'm going to take a few minutes to talk a little bit about it, about the controls, about my experiences with it, and maybe a little bit about XM in general. First, I want to tell you this is a very low-tech recording. I've got the XM radio playing in the background here, and I'm using a little iRiver digital recorder to make this podcast. Turn the music down here for just a minute while we get started. I've had the XM radio service for about 10 months now, and the Delphi MiFi is the only receiver I have, and I've been using it and enjoying it now for about 10 months. Most of the features on it I found to be fairly accessible, so I'm going to talk a little bit about those and maybe also talk a little bit about some of the ones that are maybe not quite as accessible. And there are some others that I think I may be able to use a little bit better as I get a chance to work with them and practice with them, particularly the menus. Let me go into a little bit of a description of the device itself. I would describe the MiFi unit itself, when it's disconnected from all of its attachments and stands and everything, as being a little bit like an oversized bar of soap, and about that same weight too. It fits easily in the palm of your hand. The front of the device has an LCD display, which covers about the top half of the front of the device. And in the center, right about in the middle of the front of the device, just below the display, is a four-way rocker switch, and you'll hear me call this the four-way rocker switch. It rocks up, down, left, and right. You could think of those as directional keys. The default for the up and down is to control the volume. Left and right switches you between different genres of music. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. On either side of this four-way rocker switch are three buttons, three on each side. The three on the left from top to bottom are to go, that's the number 2, G-O. Below that is the mode button. The mode button switches between what's called My XM and Live. Below the mode button is the DRR/PRE button, which is direct or preset. We'll talk a little bit more about the presets here in just a few minutes. To the right of the four-way rocker switch, at the top we have the menu button, and just below that is the memory button, and below the memory button is the display button. Along the bottom half of the device, in sort of an arch, in fact in a shape that looks a little bit like a smiley face, are two rows of numbers. The top row in that arch is the numbers 1 through 5, and below that are the numbers 6 through 0. And these are actually, these two rows of buttons are actually little rocker switches, so that you can rock the switch up or down for the top row or the bottom row of numbers. And this is where you, of course, directly tune to different channels. For instance, right now I'm listening to jazz, which is 70. If I wanted to go to the classical station at channel 110, I can just enter it on those numbers, and in a second or two, it switches me to classical music. And we'll talk a little bit more about the stations on XM and how they're arranged, because they're pretty easy to remember. It's pretty easy to get the kind of music you want. Back to the controls, on the right-hand edge of the device, there is a thumb wheel. The thumb wheel has little detents or indents on it, so that you actually use that to switch between stations, or if you're in the menus, to switch between menu options, and then that thumb wheel can be pushed in to make a selection. On the top right edge, is the power button, and on the top left edge is the jack where you plug in the headphones. On the left edge, near the top, is the jack where you plug in the little wearable antenna that comes with the MiFi receiver. And then below that is a reset button. It's kind of indented. You have to put something in it to push it to reset the device back to the factory defaults. On the back, there's a button that releases the battery cover. And on the bottom edge of the unit is the place where it plugs into the two stands that we're going to talk about in just a minute. And that's it. As I said, it's very portable, fits right in the palm of your hand, and fairly easy to operate. I sort of think of the XM MiFi as the Swiss Army knife of XM receivers, because it has so many different attachments that go with it. It can be used in the home, in the car, or as a portable receiver. And the way you switch between the three is pretty neat, because there is a stand for the home, and the MiFi plugs right into the top of the stand, and then the indoor antenna plugs directly into the stand. The AC adapter plugs directly into to the stand, and then there's also a line out so you can plug the stand directly into your stereo receiver or amplifier. So all you have to do if you want to use the MiFi in your home is just pop it up on its stand and it's ready to go. There's a similar stand that goes in the car, and there's a variety of ways to mount that stand in the car. And it's removable too, so that you can easily take it out of the car to avoid it being stolen or something. The car stand has similar plug or jacks on the back. It has a jack for the car antenna, which is different from the indoor antenna. It has a plug for a car adapter that plugs from a cigarette type power outlet into the back of the car stand. And then there is a line out on the car stand as well. And that line out, can go to the cassette adapter so that you can play the MiFi through the cassette player in your car. Or if you are fortunate enough to have a line in jack on your car stereo, you can plug it directly in. Another option for listening to the MiFi, which is especially handy on the car, is the MiFi's built-in FM transmitter. If the MiFi is not plugged into speakers or headphones, it automatically turns on the XM transmitter. From the menus, there's a way to select what frequency it'll use. And then you can tune it directly in on your car stereo. And actually, that's the way we use it most of the time when we're listening to it in the car. It works quite well. Back to some jazz here. There, that's better. And that's pretty much it for the physical thing. Oh yeah, I do need to talk about the wearable part of it, the portable way you use the receiver. It's pretty simple. The MiFi comes with a belt clip that can be used to just clip the device itself onto your belt, and it also has a small case that has a belt clip so that you can put it in the case and put that on your belt. It can receive signals from XM transmitters that are in the area if you happen to be in a city or in an area where there's one available. It also has a small wearable antenna, which can either be clipped to your clothing or with a little attachment, it can even be mounted to a window using a little suction cup. So there's three different ways you can use the MiFi, and it has all these different attachments that let you use it fairly conveniently in all three modes, car, home, or as a wearable device. Talk a little bit about XM and about the way the stations are arranged and what you can get and how to tune to those on the MiFi. There's actually a couple of different ways you can get to a station you want. The way that I use most of the time is direct tuning, and it's pretty easy once you become familiar with the layout to get to what you want. The first few channels on XM radio are the decades, so that you can go, for instance, if I want to go listen to music from the 40s, I can just hit channel 4, and in a few seconds it should switch me to some very old music. There it is. And if I want to go to the 60s, I can hit 6 and it'll jump me right up to the 60s. Or if I want to get something a little more modern, I can hit 90s. The kind of music my kids listen to most of the time, I think. From 10 up to 19 are where the country stations are all organized. So if I want to go to a country station, I can start on 10. I can punch that directly in using the number keys. And I go to the country. And if I just want to scroll through the country stations, I don't have to punch in every number. I can use the little thumb wheel. And one interesting thing about the thumb wheel is the first channel, you actually have to go 2 indents down with the thumb wheel. And another confusing thing to me about the MiFi, which I've gotten used to now, is that if you roll the thumb wheel down, that's actually going up the channel. So if I'm on 10 now, if I want to go to 12, I go 2 indents, push in on the thumb wheel, it takes me to the next station, which of course in this case is another country station. And I can tune through those fairly easy. Turn that up just a little bit, and I can turn it down for the MiFi. Might be a little too loud, I don't know. So anyway, it's pretty easy to tune. Now the rocker switches I mentioned earlier, As I said, the up and down one controls the volume, but it only controls the volume for the headphone jack. Right now, I'm actually using the car cradle, and I've got it plugged in using the line-in adapter. So I actually have to control the volume on the receiver rather than on the device itself. The left and right move me through the different genres of music, and this is not really accessible because it actually displays the genre you're on the screen, but it can be used in that. For instance, I'm on country now. If I hit right and then tune down a couple, it's put me into a different genre. And these, I think, are going to be the easy listening channels. Yeah, this is the 20s. It's like easy listening, movies, Broadway, soft rock, those kinds of things. The 30s, there's about three Christian or gospel stations. The 40s get into the more rock and roll kinds of songs. 40 is deep tracks. They play some of the more obscure tunes. I don't keep up with many of those in the 40s, except 46 is top tracks, which is some of the better known metal, heavy metal, rock and roll type songs. 50s, 60s, I don't listen to those very much. Then in the 70s you get into the jazz and blues, those kinds of things, and on up. The next place where I tend to like to stop a lot is up in where the news and information is. That starts at 120. I can't remember what 120 is. It might be. I don't know if that's... Okay, it actually starts with 121. That's Fox News. ...Supreme Court and his new book... 122 is CNN, 123 is CNN Headline, and it goes on it through some weather. If I want to go to NPR, I can go to 133. That's going to take me to NPR. And as you go on up, you get to, you know, different things. There's one that's, there's a couple of stations that play radio shows, like dramas, radio dramas. There's quite a few talk radio stations, which I don't listen to all that often myself. Major League Baseball is in the 175 through 189 range. XM broadcast every single game, Major League Baseball game, throughout the season this year. Then when you get to 190 and up, you're getting into the ACC and Big Ten basketball and football conferences. And I like sports, so they're pretty fun to listen to sometimes. Now, this is all using the direct mode. Remember, I mentioned a few minutes ago that just to the bottom, to the lower left, just to the left and at the bottom from the four-way rocker switch, is the /pre. The MiFi has 30 presets that you can set, and they're in banks. You have the direct bank, which is where you tune directly to stations. Then if I push that Dur Pre button one more time, it gets me to the first bank of presets. I think I have some of these set, but I don't know what I have them set to. The first one is like the news and information. It's real easy to set them. To set a preset, you just hold it down. So, for instance, if I want to go to, I'll set one for the 70s, let's say. I can go to the 70s, and then I'll go to the first, I'll set that the first preset. And there you go. I want to talk a little bit about the button that's to the left in the middle. I'm sorry, I got a little distracted there for a minute. I started listening to the radio. Let me go back to direct, and let's tune. It's easy to lose track of whether I'm on direct or pre, because it tells you on the screen, of course, but I just have to count. I know there's direct, and then there's three sets of presets, which gives you 30 presets in all. Now, immediately to the left of the four-way rocker switches, as I was talking about, is the mode button, and that sets you between live and what's called MyXM. The little XM receiver, the MiFi, has the ability to record up to 5 hours of programming that you can listen to later, which is pretty handy and fairly accessible. The only drawback is that there's not really an easy way to go and delete segments that you've recorded. It's done through the menus, and the menus are not very accessible. But if I want to switch from live and go to what I recorded earlier, I can do that. I can just hit the mode button, which is to the left of the four-way rocker, as I said, and it will go to what I've recorded. Looks like I don't... Oh, yeah, there's what I've recorded. When you're in the MyXM mode, you can go from song to song by pressing the left and right on the four-way rocker switch. So I can go from song to song. And it actually displays the song that I'm listening to up on the LCD display. So somebody who can read the display there can actually look and see what song they're listening to. And you can also use the thumb wheel that's on the right edge of the device to scroll through the songs that have been recorded. Now, I recorded these on here by using the upper left button just to the left and up from the four-way rocker switch. That's that two-go button that I mentioned earlier, the number two in GO. If I go back to live, and I'll switch back to 70s. That's my generation.
All XM7 on the phone.
And if I press the two-go button twice, then that starts recording. So I'm now recording what's playing on the XM radio right now. And I can record as long as I want to.
Ask for Garlo Fandango now! Here are the Temptations when they were only 13
years old. Now we're going to get to listen to some Temptations, except I'm going to stop the recording. And I'm going to then go down and press the mode button. And I'm going to see if I can find what we were just listening to on here. And I've got a lot of stuff on here, so I just have to sort of scroll through. So it may take me a minute to actually find it. Let's go through. This is a lot of stuff that I recorded earlier today. Just to try to wrap things up here, as I was saying there, once you've recorded your 5 hours, the MiFi will begin to overwrite the oldest material you have, so you can essentially just continue recording and it'll keep the last 5 hours of whatever programming that you recorded. There are also some ways to set scheduling, which I have not learned how to use yet. They're buried in the menus somewhere, but you can actually set two schedules so that you can set a certain time for the MiFi to come on and record. You turn the unit off, and at that time, it'll turn itself on and begin to record the material that you set it to. That's about it for now. Maybe we can do another podcast later to talk a little bit more about the menus and try to see how easily those can be used. That's all for now. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks.
All right. Before we go, we do have a winner for the mystery sound number 7.
Okay, you got me. Been going around the house with Dana again trying to figure out what this sound could be, and I came up with something else, and maybe the reason Rob won't give it to me. How about the fire extinguisher? Usually, mine makes a little more noise than that, but I decided to take it out on the back porch and give it a little test shot.
He's motivated.
Like.
He's a motivated
genius. It
sort
of kind of sounded like that, so I figured I'd give it a shot. The reason this is of such interest to me, I used to teach sensory awareness classes at a Center for the Blind, and we used to play this game with our students, especially the newly blinded ones. Got the biggest kick out of it. It's a lot of fun, and kind of lightens up the stress load for those that are newly blinded to play a game like that. And radio stations have done this, and I've been quite good at it. And I just refuse to give up on you. So, Rob, give me a break, man. Anyway, you guys have a good one. Talk to you later. Bye.
You going to give him a break, Rob?
Oh, yeah. I bet you he's good at that radio station calling thing. I've seen some radio stations do that. And I have to say, I just never thought anybody would get it. And I'm glad you didn't want to let it go any longer. You wanted to give people a break on it. And I said, no, just hold it out there a little bit longer. Man.
There's somebody out there that can do it. We found him.
I hope Dana didn't waste too much of his fire extinguisher. I don't know that they're meant to be shot and then put back and used in a real fire.
Well, we used two just for this mystery sound.
That's
at
right.
least.
But I always wanted to know what it was like to shoot one off. And I had one I was going to throw away, and I thought... no better opportunity than now to get out the R1 and go ahead and get a sample of this fire extinguisher while I'm doing it. And I didn't know it was going to be so useful.
See, I didn't like that one at all because I couldn't get it any way close. But now that we know what it is, oh, yeah, yeah.
And my clue So Larry, back then, this mystery scent actually came out a while back, and it didn't make it onto the podcast. My clue was White Fog in the Backyard. And he's like, no, I don't have a clue what you're talking about. And that's really what it was like. It was just all this, you know, white, foggy, powdery mist all over the place, and I emptied that baby out and threw it away. So what a crazy experience. And now I know how to shoot one, and Dana knows how to know what one sounds like. Now the rest of you guys do too, so we're all in good shape.
Do you want to tell us anything about this next mystery sound, Ron?
I guess I can't, because I don't know what it is.
That's the one we were talking about earlier.
No, I think we've said enough. We will dig it up and get it on shortly. And somebody will get it. This is easier than the fire extinguisher.
Well, I don't think so.
We'll give you I have an appropriate clue. If the time should arise that we need to use a clue.
Hello, Larry and Blind Cool Tech listeners. This is Robert Carter. Just wanted to leave a couple brief comments about some things that have been discussed on Blind Cool Tech lately. First of all, I love the ambience, the atmosphere of Blind Cool Tech, because people are really starting to share important and personal things about themselves and actually getting support and help from one another. And that is so way cool. It's something that's been needed, in my opinion, for so very long in the community of those of us who are blind. I have to admit, even though I try to keep my psychologist hat off, it does an old psychologist good to hear people really helping each other and discussing things of importance the way that are going on. I'm talking about the relationship issues, blind-sighted issues, and just the whole idea of demands of daily living, dealing with food and everything else. Anyway, it's very cool. Second comment that I wanted to make was that I am a user of the Bose headphones that were discussed in the recent feedback show, and I really love them. Headphones are very subjective, and so I'd encourage anybody to listen to them before buying them, because they are $300, which is a lot to pay for headphones. And I thought long and hard about it before I bought them a couple of years ago, but they really are wonderful, assuming that you like the Bose sound. Third thing, about the headphones also, I think I haven't heard them, but I've heard really good things about a Sennheiser PX250 noise-canceling headphones. They're about half the cost, I believe, of the Bose, and I think they're just reported to be quite good, but I have not heard them myself. Third thing that I wanted to comment on was just briefly about this whole accessible recording capability issue with the accessible recorders. And I'm a user of the Plextalk PTR1. I bought it a few years ago before the other recorders were out. But even so, I still think it's the only truly accessible recorder out there. I understand why people hesitate about it because of one, of its price, which is really expensive at about $900, and two, because of its size. It's about the size of a book. But nevertheless, I think I've learned the value of true accessibility thanks to devices like the BookPort, the Plextalk PTR1, the Nokia cell phone with Tox on it, because it's really then that we realize how much we're missing when we have to guess about what a menu item is, or when we have to figure out workarounds just to make a simple recording, or to make sure the batteries aren't dead, or whatever the situation is. So I really hope we'll continue this fight for complete access to digital recorders. Again, I'm really enjoying the show, and thank everyone for the wonderful comments that people are making. Blind Cool Tech really turned out to be quite a wonderful venue for all of us. So long from Texas.
Excellent comments, Robert, and I couldn't agree with you more. It is really, as you well know, the user feedback that makes this so valuable to all of us, though. So I want to continue to encourage you to leave comments on the comment line like this. I really am going to need some help, though, folks, with compiling some of these emails. The Blind Cool Tech email list has generated all kinds of great discussions. If you're interested in subscribing to that, by the way, check out the contacts link at blindcooltech.com and Basically, it's just sending a blank email to blindcooltech-request@freelists.org and putting subscribe in the subject line of the message.
Hey, Larry, this is Buddy in Asheville. I'm scared to death. Man, I've come in and copied that Halloween thing to my MP3 recorder, and it didn't quite get all, well, it got all that file, didn't get all the other, the Neo viewers file. I'll have to make it a little, get a bigger player. I need to find an iRiver, FP899. Tell me where I can find one. My email address is buddyl@bellsouth.net. That's buddyl@bellsouth.net. You scared me to death with that. All that sound seeing tour of that Halloween. That was really, those bananas do a good job. And I'm having a ball of my limbs. But I want an $8.99. I can't find one. Circuit City doesn't have one. The iRiver store might. Best Buy doesn't have one. Target doesn't have one. Radio Shack doesn't have one. Kmart doesn't have one. I can't even find it on the net, and they want me to go to eBay, and I'm nervous about going to eBay. So, thank you, Larry. Enjoyed it. Well, those are good intros, too.
All right. Y'all heard the man. If anyone knows, we, Buddy and others probably would love to find out. We'd also like someone to take the challenge and try one of these new tea, either the 10 or the 30 from iRiver, and let's find out what that's all about. All right, definitely want to give credit to Steve Bauer and Kai and Jamie Pauls, all you guys sent in these intros. This is some awesome, cool stuff, and this is Blind Cool Tech.
You've been listening to Blind Cool Tech. Visit us on the web at blindcooltech.com. Our email address is blindcooltech@gmail.com, and our comment line is 206-984-9203.